What's up, safety people? In the last podcast, we spoke about risk assessments. We're going to stick on the same trend, talking about risk and risk assessments. This time, we're going to talk about quantitative and qualitative risk assessments. Those of you that do risk assessments might have been thinking over the last podcast, why didn't he talk about those two? What the fuck? Missing the complete gist of what I needed to know. Well, we're going to answer those questions today, help you decide which one to pick. Let's get into the podcast.
Health and safety is almost a victim of its own success.
Weird and oppressive regime of health and safety regulations.
A huge fire engulfs a tower block in London.
Children being forced to wear goggles to play conkers at school.
Worst oil field disaster, 164 dead.
Rebranding Safety, the modern health and safety podcast, crushing the stereotype. Brought to you by Risk Fluent and your host, James McPherson. So, quantitative and qualitative risk assessments. First things first, let's get a bit of a debate out of the way. So, quantitative, meaning measuring by data and digits and numbers and the amount of something, and qualitative, meaning measuring by the quality of something, or not numbers. So, there are two types of risk assessments, and one uses numbers and one doesn't. So let's just kind of iron out the creases at first. A quantitative risk assessment is not what we normally see and refer to as quantitative risk assessments. They're actually risk assessments with risk scoring matrix on. A quantitative risk assessment is a massive collection of data and repetitions of probabilities over and over and over again that then calculates the most statistical probability, basically. And these are for like real high risk industries, for like chemical and nuclear, and actually most of us that debate in the safety industry about, you know, quantitative and qualitative risk assessments and the benefits, pros and cons of each are actually full of crap, because it's not a quantitative risk assessment, it's actually just a qualitative risk assessment with risk scoring on it. So when we talk about it today, we're just talking about normal risk assessments with no risk scoring matrix, which I'll call risk assessments, and then a risk assessment with a risk scoring matrix on it, which I will call a risk scoring or risk scoring matrix. The main reason for calling these two is it's really difficult to keep saying quantitative and qualitative risk assessment, and I don't want to push my luck, because I think if I calculate this correctly, this will be the sixth time I've recorded this podcast. So sitting here pretty much live on Christmas Eve, I'm going to upload this as soon as I'm finished. It's been an absolute nightmare. Okay, so you might have noticed, if you re-listened to any of the old podcasts, and you would have just noticed after the hook, we have introduced a little intro. I hope you like it, guys. It's a little early Christmas present I made for myself. It just makes it feel a bit more professional. I'm trying to take steps over. I've been working really hard over the last week to try and up the sound quality, make it a bit slicker. I'm not having a great time, if I'm honest, and that's one of the reasons I've recorded this six times over. So hopefully in the new year, I get some new software and I'll try and get it a bit slicker, a bit smoother. Look forward to the new year. So this will be the last time you hear from me until the new year. I think we will come in probably the first or second Tuesday of the new year. Keep an eye on the Facebook account or page, and then you'll get updates from there. Okay, so let's crack on. So normal risk assessments then that don't use a risk scoring matrix, great examples are the ones you can download off the HSE. They're basically a list of columns, and the first column would be identify the hazard, second column would be who's going to be harmed, third column would be how they would be harmed and what you were doing, or sometimes you combine the how and the hazard together, so you might get hazard and how that might harm you, or you might get the task and the how combined. But it doesn't really matter. Basically, it's what's there that could hurt you, who could it hurt, how's it going to hurt you, and within the wider scheme of the task, what is the task you are doing. And that essentially is the first section of the risk assessment, and then the section. The second section is coming up with the control measures to protect you or your staff from that hazard. So a risk scoring matrix then is the same thing, except we add in a couple of numbers. So basically we'd identify the hazard and identify who's going to be harmed and how they would be harmed. And then we would assign a number based on probably like a little 5x5 box of the severity. So how bad would the incident be if this happened, for example? So it'll go from number one being sometimes no first aid incident, just a basic, you know, plaster or something like that, or a little, oh, you bugger, that hurt, but crack on. Number two might be a first aid incident, and then you go all the way up to like five, where we hit fatality, okay? And then in the next column, you would then have likelihood. So you would have basically one would be like nigh on impossible, and five would be like imminent. And then what that does is then you combine the two numbers together, and if I remember rightly, I think you timed them together, and you can, they normally give you a little 5x5 box, and then what that does is give you an overall risk rating. And then that helps you kind of decide or show what level of risk that task is. So let's talk about some pros and cons of risk scoring then. So obviously the pros of risk scoring will be kind of the cons on the not risk scoring, and the cons of risk scoring would be the pros of not risk scoring. I hope that makes sense. I think that makes sense. I don't know. Anyway, let's crack on. So pros of risk scoring. They can be unbelievably helpful to prioritise and measure within a business. They can help you develop charts and measuring the level of risk in your business or in a task or in a machine or something like that. After all, there's that saying that I can't remember for the life of me, but what's not measured doesn't get done or something like that. Number two, they can help bring perspective to people who are not really used to doing risk assessments. You know, so some people work better with numbers. So if you say one is nothing and five is fatality, then people will be like, oh, okay, I get that. And it might be really easy for them, or easier then, for them to develop that risk assessment. Quick identification of risk. It is really easy, especially when you add rag charts to it, like red, amber, greens, onto the end of it, to identify a high-risk portion of a task or a high-risk task within the business or something, because there's a big red box that says high or something like that. And that's really good, especially if you've got like really long, drawn-out risk assessments. So you might need, because you've got like, say, machineries normally have like a massive raft of risk assessments. So within that and within the tasks of running that machine, you might have the whole thing. And then within that, there's one bit that's really high risk, and you can highlight that as high, and it's really easy to identify that nice and quickly. So let's talk about some cons then. In my experience, sometimes the number, or actually quite a lot of the time, the numbers can really distract you from the point of the risk assessment, which is mainly to highlight significant risks and control them. We spoke about that in the last risk assessment, didn't we? A lot of the times, people also overcomplicate the numbering system. So the most common is 5x5. I've seen some really crazy numbering systems over these. And the reason for that is the next con, which is because it can be really difficult to pick out of only five options, especially for severity sometimes. You know, it's really on perception. And we spoke about perception of risk in the last one, didn't we? And then finally, it can encourage you sometimes to not do anything. So sometimes it will give you, you'll do your calculation and it might say, for example, some of the ones I've seen, it might say low risk equals no action. So you don't do anything, when actually it might be really easy for you to do something. It might be reasonably practicable for you to do something. Therefore, technically you're not complying with the law. That aside, law aside, the point is it's really easy to do. So just do it. And the numbers and the numbering systems and the scoring systems and setting levels and stuff like that can really distract you from the main point of the risk assessment, and you end up doing a risk assessment for the sake of doing a risk assessment. So next we're going to talk about some examples, basically, or some scenarios, basically, about kind of trying to put those pros and cons into perspective. First things first, you know, we've got to say that the HSE give you a template for a risk assessment, and it does not have a risk scoring basis. It does not have a risk scoring system on there. So that's them kind of saying to you, we're going to do it without the numbering systems. However, like I've said, there are clear benefits to using a risk scoring system, a numbering system. And I can understand why there's so many businesses out there that pick these up and run with them, because they do give businesses some clear benefits. So anyway, let's talk about some examples to really bring the points home. Okay, so if you're going to use the risk numbering system, here's an example where we might start to struggle. So we're going to talk about severity in this one. This one uses the severity numbering system as an example. So one, let's say that was a first aid incident, and five is a fatality. So if we're going to talk about a trip, yeah? So in my last podcast, I said that a trip is not normally a significant hazard or significant finding, therefore it shouldn't be on your risk assessment. So there are industries where a trip could be significant. I don't know, that's on you to decide, but I'm not saying that it never should, and I'm not saying you should take my word for gospel. What I'm trying to do is open your eyes a little bit and give you some food for thought, get my words out, for you to just kind of step back and take a think about it. But let's just talk about the numbers then. So if you've got a trip, for example, normally that's can range from like a minor bruise all the way up to a broken bone. So just within those two, that's a massive range of injuries, isn't it? I mean, we're talking minor bruise or broken bone. Then we're talking what broken bone? Broken pinky, broken thumb, broken wrist, broken arm, you know, fingers and digits, not riddles. You know, any other bone is a riddle. That's just jumped up. So you might have, say, first aid incident, a broken bone non-riddle, a broken bone riddle. We're at 3 already. We've only got two more, and it's a fatality. We're sitting at fatality. And as much as it pains me to say, a trip could result in a death. It really could. Some crazy thing could happen. But it's not reasonably practicable for you to kind of come to that conclusion that it could come to a death. So really what we're saying here is that it can cause different results. And that can result in panic sometimes. If you set something a high risk, it can cause just nightmares. I mean, if we look at the back of kind of Grenfell, and we think about, you know, if you lived in a high-rise block of flats and you saw that on the news, and then you saw what people are saying about cladding, for example, you know there's cladding on your building, or you think there's cladding on your building, you could quite rightly start to panic. And that is a over-exaggerated example of what could happen in your business. You might say, you know, one day this is really high risk, and that caused an absolute panic, and then people say, we're not going to do that anymore, and we stop the process, and then you stop making products, and then that product then delays, that argument then delays the customer's delivery, then that customer goes elsewhere, and boom, we've lost the customer. And as we said in another podcast, safety is not the first thing that we think about. Safety is just habitual within our business, it's a habit, yeah? Our first priority is being a business and making a profit, yeah? That's what businesses are. So let's not kid ourselves. And risk assessment should enable you to do that. So that's just one example of how perception of risk, as we spoke about in the last podcast as well, combine that with a risk numbering system can just blow something way out of proportion. The numbering systems can also take you away from reasonably practicable. So we talked about it earlier. So let's put an example to what I talked about earlier. We got a brightly coloured extension lead in a well-lit basement, for example, and that basement, let's say, is only accessed once a year, for example. That then, quite rightly, would result in us identifying that risk as low, yeah? Therefore, nothing to be done. Or, therefore, it's not significant, and it probably wouldn't even go in writing on our risk assessment if we're doing it correctly, right? So, we add a numbering system to that, and that numbering system will produce a number, a risk number, and then that will produce an action. Yeah, so what that action normally is low, brackets, no action, or tolerable risk, or something like that, okay? That then encourages you not to do something. You're like, I don't need to do anything because the numbers say it's a low risk and I don't need to do anything. So then you don't do anything and you don't move that extension lead. But actually, let's say, for example, that trip that we just spoke about does happen, right? And someone trips over and they do die, right? And you're thinking, well, I'm fine. I didn't put that on there because it's not a significant hazard, and you are correct. However, the HSC inspector comes in and you still get torn a new arsehole. Why is that? Well, that's because you didn't do what's reasonably practicable, because it turns out it was actually really easy for you to move that extension lead and provide another solution which removed the hazard. Therefore, you didn't comply with the law. So whilst I'm saying don't record all your significant hazards, and that's correct, what I'm also saying is don't just do nothing because it's not significant. What I'm saying is just do something if it is reasonable to do it. If you look at it and go, it's a low risk, but you know what, I could just plug it in that plug around the corner, we'd get the same job done, and the cable would run along the wall and not be a tripping hazard. You know, that's reasonably practicable, and that's the definition of a risk assessment. So some of you might be sitting there saying, it's not significant, I wouldn't write it down, you know, I wouldn't consider it. I'm not saying you don't consider low risk items. What I'm saying is you don't record them and create yourself work. We consider low risk stuff day to day in our normal jobs, in our normal day to day life, sorry. So you go to cross a road, not at a crossing, and you've essentially done a risk assessment in your head. Yeah? You're on the way to the football and you're walking in the middle of the road singing your chanting your songs, because that's just what football fans do. Actually, I think that's just what all sports fans do, if I'm honest. But you've made a risk assessment. Yeah, you've made a risk assessment. You in your head have subconsciously considered that it's 30 miles an hour speed limit. You know, they know the big game on. You know, it's the likelihood, there's so many of us here, of a car just running through us all, is really, really low. Most people just beep and we'll all get out of the way and then they carry on. Yeah, so you've done a risk assessment. You don't have to write that down, but you have done a risk assessment. So that's two examples and a slight digression, but it's two examples. So just to kind of tie that one example up, I'm not saying don't consider low risk items or insignificant risks. What I'm saying is you should record significant risk, and stuff that's not significant enough to put on your risk assessment, you should just either deal with or do what's reasonably practicable. Or if it's not reasonably practicable, then you don't do something. Okay. So using the same risk matrix, a well-controlled adventure activity, for example, such as cave diving or climbing, may result in us identifying the level of risk as high or intolerable, meaning we don't do it, despite the fact that the organisation or us, for example, might have implemented reasonably practicable controls and therefore it's reasonably safe. Given the nature of the kind of business, if you're in that kind of industry, there is inherent risk within that job. And most of the customers that do that know that. And that is a great example of risk assessment. We touched on it in the last podcast, didn't we? Where we spoke about like movie industries and stuff like that. And I probably waffled on a bit much about Tom Cruise because I've got a bit of a man crush on him. But what I'm trying to say here is that an industry like that, they have to do a risk assessment, but 9 times out of 10, they just do it subconsciously because they're trained professionals in climbing or cave diving or whatever. But if we implement a numbering system onto that, there's probably no way that you can avoid that raising it up as a high risk job, which might say that you don't do it anymore. So how do you get around that? Well, sometimes I've seen quite a clever way of using risk numbering systems, which is kind of when I don't mind risk numbering systems, when you do it twice within the assessment. So you would number the risk without controls. So you would identify the hazard, identify who's going to get harmed and how they would get harmed. Then you would number the severity, number the likelihood, and produce a risk number. Then you would write in a column next to it your control measures. So you would implement your controls. Then you would renumber the system. So you would give it a new severity number, a new likelihood number, and therefore produce a new risk number, which should be lower than the original. I'm not saying it will definitely be. Sometimes you might implement a control and actually severity is so high that it's not really changed anything, or vice versa. So I do like it when you use those two numbering systems, and I think that's a way to kind of nip in the bud kind of some of the problems that we've raised previously. Now, if there's any of you out there that have done NCRQ qualifications, you'll probably have noted that their opinion of risk numbering systems on risk assessments is threefold. One, they're not suitable for determining if enough has been done to comply with the law. Two, they're very subjective and can produce inconsistent results. Three, the reliance of scoring risk can result in inadequate safety precautions being taken to control risk, or conversely, additional costly measures introduced where not needed. And most of those kind of get nipped in the bud if we deal with perception of risk. So if you've got a good team of people doing a risk assessment, essentially you'll probably solve some of these problems before they've even arose. And on that point, it kind of means that they're not all that bad. And actually, I'm gonna be honest with you. I'm a bit of a hypocrite sitting here and kind of moaning about them, because whilst I'm not a massive fan of risk numbering systems, I've only actually done a small handful of non-risk numbering system risk assessments. Wow, that's even more of a mouthful than quantitative and qualitative risk assessment. So I've only done a handful of ones without a risk numbering system. Why is that? Because they're industry standard. Let's not kid ourselves. They are pretty much industry standard now. I've not come across one major business or one even small business that doesn't do them. Even though, in theory, the first place we should go for a template is a HSE, and they give us ones without a numbering system. So there is a demand there. And where there's a demand, it means either it's a fad. Is it a fad? I don't think so, because I've been in this game for a while now, and it's been there since I started, before I started, and it's still there now. So I don't think it's a fad. So that means for me that they're required and that they do have benefits. And I touched on some of the benefits earlier, didn't I? And in my experience, you know, when you start using these numbering systems quite cleverly outside of the risk assessments, you combine that with RAG charts, etc. And let's be honest, all boardrooms love RAG charts, and even senior managers do. These are really useful ways to highlight and display and depict risk to senior management that have got other priorities. And it's a real good way, say for example, if your CEO was going to do safety tours around the factory, for example, well, it might be a good way for him or her to pick somewhere to go. So they're going to go look at the high-risk jobs once a quarter or every 6 months. And then in between, on the other quarters, they might then go and see the medium to low-risk jobs or something like that. But you get the gist of it. It can be real good for displaying it to, you know, and not to stereotype finance departments, but they normally like to deal in numbers. And sometimes, you know, giving them a risk assessment in numbers helps them. And you know what? Let's be honest, guys, and I am going to do a podcast about this, but finance people should be, if not just as good as you, maybe better at risk assessments, because they do exactly the same thing as what you're doing, but they look at risk of money, risk of losing, risk of investment, a return on investment, and things like that. So they're doing exactly the same thing. And I'm going to talk about how, you know, risk department should be start to evolve into just being one department, and safety should be part of that. And there should just be essentially, you know, a risk department, not a health and safety department. But that, I'm digressing anyway. So that's a different podcast. So we spoke about quite a bit. And in summary, kind of what I'm saying here is that whatever type of, excuse me, that wasn't me, it's my dog underneath the table rubbing his eyes or whatever. He does this weird thing where he like rolls on the floor, but now he decided for the first time ever to do it right underneath the table where I'm working. So this podcast is just like cursed. So I'm just going to crack on and hope that you didn't hear that and you're just like, what is going on? So anyway, in summary, guys, people, what I'm saying here is it doesn't really matter what template you use. If you've got good training in place, you've got a good culture in place, it doesn't matter what you use. It really doesn't. And if one way benefits your business more than the other, then do it that way. I really don't care. I prefer you focus on what we spoke about in the last podcast. And you need to focus on building a culture. And whilst culture is a word that annoys me slightly because we seem to all jump on it and we seem to say, oh yeah, well that's the culture, or yeah, we need to work on building a better culture. There's a lot more that goes into that, and I am going to talk about culture, and I am going to do a separate podcast on my kind of thinkings around culture. But just to kind of give you a couple of snippets of that, what we spoke about in the last podcast is essentially the first step, or one of the first steps, to building a positive culture. And it's not a positive safety culture, it should just be a positive culture within your business. Yeah, so a positive culture is everything: financial, it's operational, it's safety, it's absolutely everything, all in one. And the reason why I get a bit annoyed, but it, because it, to build a good culture is actually thousands upon thousands of tiny little things that you might do right or wrong in your business, which will then inherently kind of affect your culture. And risk assessments is one of the biggest ones there. There is no magic wand for fixing your culture, unfortunately. But risk assessments, in my opinion, is one of the biggest, the closest things you'll get to that magic wand. If you go over the top on your risk assessment, you inherently straight away damage your culture. But if you don't do that, and you, whoever you are listening to this podcast, you are doing those risk assessments, and then outside of those risk assessments, you become the living embodiment of that positive culture that you imagine, that's infectious, and you will infect your colleagues on this culture, and it will start to spread. So be the living embodiment of the culture that you envision. Do your risk assessments of focusing on the things we spoke about in the last podcast, and essentially go out and spread the infection throughout your business. That's it, guys. That's the end of this podcast. And that's also the end of 2018 from Rebranding Safety, Risk Fluent, and myself, James McPherson. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. We've talked about using and not using risk scoring matrices. Oh, do you know what? I can't get my words out on this podcast. It seems to be cursed. I'd like to probably say on that note, I apologise for the quality of this podcast because it is terrible. It's all over the place. It's messy. And it got to a point, guys, sixth time over, where I'm just like, do you know what? I'm just rolling with this. So for anything you hear in the background, or noises or weird sounds or mismatched words, I do apologise, but I've just given up. It's on a positive note. I've been trying to improve the quality of the audio for you guys and the overall kind of professionalism, God, of the podcast. That's it. We talked about risk assessments in the last two. I think in the new year, you'll probably hear from me first or second week of the new year. Keep your eye out on Facebook and Twitter. We'll let you know. But I think we'll continue the trend of risk assessing and risk management and risk as a concept. I think there's a lot to talk about around that kind of one word, risk. So it's Christmas Eve. Enjoy yourselves, have a lovely Christmas and an amazing new year. It's my favourite time of the year. I think it's the only time where most people in England are quite nice to each other. And it's the only time of the year that weirdos like me and my mum say hello to everyone on a dog walk, get hellos back and not weird looks. Enjoy yourself, be with friends, be with family, give gifts, receive gifts and whatever. If you don't celebrate Christmas, I hope you got some time off and you enjoy the holidays. If you haven't got time off, then I hope everyone's being nice and it's not as bad as a normal day. I hope it's lenient on you. So I'll see you in the new year, guys. Have a great time. Thanks for listening. Lots of love. Bye-bye.